Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Therese Miklow. Therese has been educating leaders for over 20 years. She is the co-author of the book, The Facilitation Advantage, and she serves both through her own practice and as the Director of Facilitation Excellence at Protus International. She leverages her life lessons, her master's in psychology, and her business experience to teach leaders how to apply key facilitation skills in every conversation, not just presentations, not just when they're running meetings, but in every conversation that they have. It's a wonderful conversation. There's great back and forth. She makes all kinds of great points. I really enjoyed the conversation. I'm excited to share it with you today. She's going to talk about all kinds of cool things, like how leaders can improve their performance range, which is a wonderful topic. She's going to talk about how facilitation skills can help us all increase our ability to influence others, why it is so important to activate our content for our audiences, and a very unique point of view that I hadn't heard before about how do we separate or differentiate justifying from listening. It's a great conversation, and I really am excited to share it with you all today. Thank you so much for being here for another episode. We appreciate it. While you're here, please just take a quick second, like the show, subscribe to the show, leave us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Also, please quickly check out our sponsors. If you haven't already, head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training to develop the skills necessary to recognize what people are likely thinking and feeling by identifying shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers listening, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn not everything you can get, but everything you can give and contribute to the International Association of Interviewers. And that's where also we can get all your questions answered on the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And while you're online, head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, negotiators, HR teams, and more, to teach them the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to unlock the everyday confessions hiding in all of our high-value conversations. We really appreciate you being here for another great episode. Thank you so much. So now, without further ado, I introduce to you Therese Miklow. Good morning, Therese. It is a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. And I was very interested as I was preparing the show for to learn more about your background, what you do, what you teach. And honestly, I was just fascinated by the title of your book. As somebody who speaks a lot and works with a lot of people who speak a lot, your book that you co-authored, The Facilitation Advantage, just that title alone grabbed me. So if I can open the conversation by asking, could you please walk us through what is The Facilitation Advantage?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, I think most of us might think of the word facilitate or facilitation and think like, that's not for me. That's like what a professional facilitator or trainer does. And we wrote this book because we think facilitation is a skill that everyone needs and particularly leaders need, because the root word facilitate, the Latin root, is to make things easy, to render less difficult. And I love that definition because I think that that's most of our jobs these days, to make it easier for people to get on board with a change, to make it easier in a meeting for people to understand a new direction, to make it less difficult for people to understand a new methodology or a new process or approach. And so with that in mind, this book, Facilitation Advantage, is the idea that what most of us are going to need as the world continues to evolve is a set of skills that sit alongside our functional skills, our subject matter skills, because we need to be able to influence, we need to communicate, we need to collaborate, we need to get a lot of things done with and through others. And oftentimes we rely heavily on our functional skill, if you're an engineer or a salesperson or marketing person. And what I have found through my career is that's not enough. And so the facilitation advantage is this idea that there are a set of skills that you can develop that are like choices. that when you are in any situation, whether it's a difficult conversation, whether you have to lead a change, whether you're facing a lot of obstacles or disagreement or people aren't on board with it, that you can choose from to be able to have the outcome that you want.
I love it. It's, for me, fewer things make me happier in these conversations than when, like, 30 seconds in, somebody says something that makes me go, hell yeah. And to hear you say, like, the root cause of facilitation is to make it, or the, like, the Latin root definition of the word is to make things easy. Uh-huh. That is fantastic. And I'm completely biased, but I agree 100% that that is our role as leaders, as parents, is if our job is to communicate with somebody else to change their mind or change their behavior, then that is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And even sometimes, I promise I'm not making this about me, but I had something and I don't know another way to say it. So
no,
I'm going to say it.
Tell me how you're receiving it. This is good.
Like, a lot of times when I'm teaching, I'll refer to the person you're talking to as your audience. Mm-hmm. And then people will say, well, wait a minute. Do you mean like if I'm having a conversation or giving a presentation? Well, it doesn't matter. Like if you're interacting with somebody, they are your audience. So I love hearing how your approach, again, obviously I'm biased, but it aligns with that, focused around how do we make it easier for people to understand, adapt, change, employ, so forth. You mentioned a core set of skills. I'm never going to ask somebody to give away their whole book, but what are, if you don't mind me asking, the main skills or the most important skills that leaders or anybody can learn in order to create this facilitation advantage?
Yes. Okay. So we put the skills in three main buckets, if you will. There's mindset, because everything, Michael, really comes from the voice in your head. You know, to the degree that you're aware that you talk to yourself, it's incredibly important that what you're saying to yourself supports whatever your goal is. So if you're going into your Monday morning staff meeting and you're already thinking to yourself, this is going to go horrible, or nobody's going to talk, or let me just get through this, I guarantee you it will show up in your behaviors, and then others are just going to react to your behavior. So mindset is one bucket. The second bucket is content. It's your subject matter expertise, but in a different twist. It's not just having subject matter expertise. It's how do you activate it for your audience, like you said. So whether you are you know, meeting in the morning with your team, then you're onboarding the summer interns, and then you have to meet with the senior executive or the customer at your global strategic account, you have to be able to transfer your subject matter expertise in a way that's going to land with those different people. So that's subject matter knowledge as well as context. The last bucket, there's mindset, there's content, and then there's process. And process is all about how do you move a group of people from point A to point B. If you're in a sales role, you've got to get them from awareness of your product and solution to buying. If you are a engineering leader and you're trying to get funding for the next phase of a project, how do you get people from being pessimistic about it to fully supporting it? How do you get people in the meeting to go from disengaged to fully engaged and, you know, willing to make it very interactive? So process contributions, we call them contributions because they're like gifts you bring into any situation, are things like presence, listening, balancing risk and safety, adapting for impact, story. You know, if you're the eighth meeting of the day, let's face it, like everybody's tired. They're tired. And how are you going to get your point across in a way that sticks with people, motivates them, gets them bought in? And oftentimes we lean a little heavy on facts and data, when really, if you had, again, another choice, the better choice might be stop with the slides, stop with the data, tell a story. So the choice is that the more you're aware of all of those, the more at any given moment, you have more options for what to do when you're faced with different scenarios and situations.
So many great points in such a short illustration. 100% right about the mindset. Like, we go where our mind's eye takes us. And I probably talk about him too much, but I've got a young son and my wife does an amazing job of consistently talking to him about how he talks to himself.
Mm-hmm. Because brilliant.
When we're young, it's even more important because we're forming our self-image. But to your point, it ends up becoming almost like target fixation. The more we think something will happen, good or bad, we're going to lead ourselves to it. And on the negative side, it's easy to blame somebody else for it, even though we walked ourselves right into it if we're not careful. So we lose that kind of internal like locus of control or sense of accountability. So such a great point there. And I love what you said too about the understand. It's not just knowing your content, but how do you, the word you used was fantastic, activate it for others. Early in my career, I had a conversation with somebody who I still have a professional relationship. He's a great guy. I look up to him in many, many ways. And I was sitting at a coffee shop in Newport Beach, California, of all places. And he told me, Mike, I'm not a content applier. I'm a content provider. And as soon as he said that, I thought to myself, thank you. I will always work hard to be a content applier.
Yeah.
And he's a genius. He's got amazing stuff. But his approach was, we have all this stuff. We give it to people. They figure out how to use it. Cool. Right. He's super successful. But for me, I was like, oh, wait a minute. I think it's a lot more important to help people understand how to use it. Like, how do we solve that riddle for them?
Mm-hmm,
so love hearing that. And when you talk about the process, I would love to continue the conversation from here for a few minutes if we can. You talked about the contributions, and if I recall correctly, there might be 10 of those if my led me in the right direction before the conversation. You talked about awareness and psychological safety and balancing that with risk. So many things. We could probably pack each one of those for its own hour-long conversation. And I know every audience and every situation is different. You brilliantly used the word context earlier. But as we're looking to move people through a process from point A to point B, what are the typical pillars that you work with for people to build that process around?
So this is in the kind of content area of the contributions. And that is that the first pillar is, where are you starting as you're getting ready for any kind of interaction or engagement where you're trying to influence? And I find that when I coach a lot of people, where they start is the slide deck, is, you know, getting all the details correct and accurate and the spreadsheets and all that. And it's really the wrong place to start. The first place is really the pillar is identifying what am I trying to accomplish? And then equally important to that is, who is my audience? And sometimes we just assume we know, or we overlook it. And without really understanding who's my audience and what do they care about, you're risking whether or not you're going to be able to make a good connection and influence. So that's the first thing. And I think the more you're a subject matter expert, the harder it is, because you want, right? You have all this, you know, great domain expertise and knowledge. And it's easy to want to apply that in ways that are not helpful to your audience. So I'm coaching a group of leaders who are responsible for a very kind of technical methodology. And they are working on this idea that when they have to talk to the senior leaders in a meeting, they're just overwhelming them, or they're assuming they understand the same acronyms, right? The same jargon. And also, like, that's not what the senior leaders care about. And so that's the number one pillar. The second pillar, I would say, if I'm pulling from these contributions, where I'd say, you know, if you're going to choose some things, here's where to go. I think the second is how you engage with presence. And we talk a bit about how executive presence, which anyone can have, you don't have to have the title of an executive, is creating connection with people so that you are feeling as though you're kind of matching their behaviors. And what I like about it is that it's not a do or don't, like, don't hold your hands this way, or don't, you know, say, you know, any filler words, because we all say filler words. It's about being able to know certain behaviors to flex when you're with certain audiences. So when I'm working with more senior leaders, we work on behaviors that make people feel more comfortable being authentic and vulnerable with senior leaders, because guess what? They can be intimidating. When I'm working with people who are high potential and are early career talent, it's how do you raise your status so that when you're in front of a more senior group of people, the impression you give is that you're confident, you're capable, you're someone I want to listen to. Have you done any work on executive presence, or what resonates with you about that, Michael?
I've done some, and thank you for asking. I love what you just said about filler words. One of the things that drives me nuts is when people, and this kind of ties back a little bit too into knowing your content.
Yeah.
When people are, if somebody is in a leadership position, they probably have 400 jobs that they're responsible
right.
for any given day. Yes. And giving a presentation or leading a meeting or whatever, that's a very small part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if they get it up and they give a presentation and they say, I'm a half a dozen times. Now, if it's every other word, that's a problem. But if they say I'm half a dozen times, well, they didn't have a week to prepare and master the content that they were going to talk about. They're thinking about it as they're going. We all use filler words. So if we're beating ourselves up every time we say the word, gets back to the negative monologue and we're driving ourselves downhill and we're creating more stress for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love what you say. From the top down, is how do we make people more comfortable?
Mm-hmm.
Because your leadership title makes people want to be less honest with you, whether you want to believe that or not. So it's how do we make people more comfortable? And then going from the other side, like you said, the high potential people that are early in their career, I don't really believe in the fake it till you make it mentality, because I feel like if you bluff, eventually it's going to get called. And when it gets called, you're screwed.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you, within your own scope of, what's the word I want to use, behavioral ability? And that might not be the right way to say it. So if people are like, what does that mean? Good question. We'll figure it out as I keep talking. But for all of us, there are things that we can probably push ourselves to do. We can act a different way. We can talk a different way. We can look a different way. But there's parameters to that.
Mm-hmm.
So if I stretch it too far, it's not just getting out of my comfort zone. It's getting out of my ability to authentically represent this.
Yeah.
So it sounds like what you're working with people on that end of the scale is help them find where that line is and then likely continue to push it and continue to develop it over time.
Yeah, exactly. We call it like almost like a performance range.
I love it. That's way better than behavior ability. Thank you so much.
Well, they were saying the same thing. It is this idea that, of course, we all have our defaults, our things that we do that make us feel comfortable. And that's fine, but the more you rise in any organization or rise as a leader, the more you have more options at the ready to be able to be flexible and versatile with the group of people that you're with. So, yeah, I think it's not about like pretending you are someone you're not. I think it's just getting comfortable with, I have more options and range than one way of operating.
Yeah, I think that's a tremendous way to put it. And I like what you said too about making it focused on your audience and what they need and how they need to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very fortunate to have a friend for decades now who is a literal genius. She's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my whole life. And you talk about slide deck. I was on her farm once helping get ready for a big presentation that she had, and she had 47 slides. And she asked me to go through it. And like, the first thing I did was I looked at the number and I was like, oh, this is going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And so essentially it was 47 slides of science, because that's her background.
Mm-hmm.
But the group that she was going to be presenting to, they just want to know that it works and what the outcome will be. And they trust that she has the science behind it. So one of the things that we really had to work hard on was take the science out.
Yeah.
Build it on what they're going to do, what the outcomes will be, and let them ask you about the science.
Yeah.
And then when they ask you about the science and you answer it, you're immediately credible because you know what you can tell them. And if they don't ask it, that's probably because your delivery was good enough that they trust you and they believe that it's there. Mm-hmm. And I struggle with that too. I don't know about you, with all the work you do. For me, it's way easier to build like a multi-day workshop than a keynote presentation. Because I want to get everything from the multi-day workshop into the keynote presentation, because I've convinced myself it's all important.
Right.
But I've got to take, 95 or more percent of it out and just say, what does this audience need for this time frame and deliver it?
Sure. Yeah. And when I feel the same, and I always start with, again, the first question is like, what's the main point? What's the main point? If I had to distill this down to its essence, what is it? Because then you just build to that. And it's so funny. Maybe you've seen this too in meetings where people are running out of time. And what they do is just speak faster. like, oh, we still have 12 slides to get through. Okay. And so they just move faster instead of in the moment, you have choice. One choice to say, you know what, we are down to the last 10 minutes. I have a lot more information to cover, but I'd love to know what's most important for you in the time we have left. That's a choice. Instead of just like continuing to talk, it would be to stop and ask a question. Another choice might be, you know, I can distill this with one quick story. You could tell a story. That's a choice. And so whenever you're feeling the urgency around time, I think it's to just, you know, even take a multi-second pause and just say, okay, you know, I have choices here, instead of just going, you know, faster. And the one skill, the other pillar, Michael, is the skill of listening. And I love all the contributions as if they are my children. But if you forced me and said, no, Therese, you have to say which one, you know, do you love the most? I would say listening. And I think it's because there's such an absence of it. And it is such an advanced skill. And most people don't have it. Like I don't know, I'd love to know your experience. I never learned listening in elementary school, middle school. I never even learned it in college. And so we don't even teach it. And then we find ourselves now needing to navigate a lot more complex conversations and difficult conversations. And we're not equipped, because the one skill that we have developed is to talk, not to really know how to draw people out or, you know, create engagement.
You're 100% right. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's probably an elementary school or a high school somewhere that has a little listening program, but basically it's not taught. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I believe that most of us are taught to communicate when we're children, mm-hmm. by adults who mm-hmm. treat us like kids. Mm. So parents, teachers, yeah. coaches, you know, whatever, Boy Scout leaders, club leaders, church leaders. If you had a lot of fun, maybe a cop or three. These are the people that teach us how to speak, but they're talking down to us because they're adults and we're kids. Mm-hmm. So then what happens is we grow up to be adults. This is how everybody has always talked to us. Mm-hmm. So now we talk to adults the same way and yeah. wonder why it is creating more conflict than it's resolving, and we're not getting the results that we anticipated.
Oh, you know, you just said something I hadn't ever thought about, but it's so wise that yes, when we're taught listening, it's basically just sit and be quiet and take it in, not what we're talking about, which is active listening, which involves a different skill set than just passively taking in what you're hearing. That's a really good point.
I agree. And honestly, my bias, and I welcome you to say anything you disagree mm-hmm. with, please. This is like, I welcome that, I promise. Yeah. But I honestly have some real reservations with how active listening is typically taught as well, because yeah. active listening is typically taught to, you know, pay attention, right? And let the other person know you're paying attention. So right. appropriate eye contact, open posture, welcoming gestures, repeat back a few things that you hear. And it's true. Like if you do those things, the other person is likely going to share more information. I would never dispute that. That mm-hmm. is clear. Mm-hmm. But how many of us, myself, absolutely, have done those things while ignoring the person talking to us? Like, I'm making you feel like I'm listening. I'm performing as if I'm yeah. listening, but I'm actually not. Right. And so I feel like, honestly, and I would love your thoughts on this, like real listening is an outcome-driven exercise. If mm-hmm. I don't have a reason to care, if I don't have a goal to tie this to, if some combination of the relationship and or initiative, outcome, result, whatever, isn't valuable enough to me, mm-hmm. then I'm just not going to listen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just how our yeah. brains were wired to work.
Yeah. And like here's the difference, because yeah, I bet when, you know, most of us are with like good friends we haven't seen in a while, we're catching up, we are totally locked in, right? We're like, oh, tell me how that went. And what happened then? Because we're naturally curious mm-hmm. with those things. But the reality is, you know, when you're working in a busy environment and you've got a ton of things on your plate, you have to activate your curiosity, because it's not going to come easy, especially when you see someone walking by and you're like, your self-talk is, I know what they're going to need. I, you know, here it comes. And so your mindset doesn't even, it turns you away from your curiosity. And when we're just not curious, we're even, you know, worse listeners. So I do think to be a good listener, it does start with mindset, because if your self-talk is, if you will just stop talking, I will give you the answer, right? Or, they're wrong, you know, or, no matter what they say, I won't agree. That's going to turn you away. And like you said, you can fake it only so well. And I actually think as humans, we're pretty good at sussing out when people are not genuinely listening. But if I could plant seeds in our brains to be a better listener, it would start with self-talk like, I only have 5 minutes, but I'm going to give them my undivided time in that 5 minutes. Or here's another good one that I sometimes go to. If they feel more heard and understood, they're more likely to listen to me. You know, especially if you go round and round with people and it's like they're a broken record. Like, here we go again. Here we go again. It's probably a signal that they don't believe you got it. And it's so easy to blame others when really you can, you know, the advantage, so to speak, is to learn more advanced skills. One, to your point about sometimes I think we fake it, and tell me how this has sounded to you when people, you maybe come back from a class or something and you're talking to them and they're like, so Michael, what I hear you saying is, how does that hit your ears when you hear, what I hear you saying is?
It doesn't bother me as much as it used to, probably because I've been in so many rooms where I hear people teach to say that. So they don't, don't say what you said, say what I heard. And I agree. Like it's probably less off-putting to say what I heard you say as opposed to saying what you just said was. So sure. I'll buy into that. Everything's contextual, of course, but I would say the two things I most likely feel in that situation is, number one, maybe I screwed it up. Maybe I confused them or I missed the mark.
Yeah.
Or number two, they're trying to use what they believe I heard to make their point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for most of us, when we hear it, it sounds like a technique.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, when is that going to wear off? Or there's something almost sinister about it. Like, you know, this is going to be how you disagree with me or debate. And in the book, we teach a completely different way that I think is much more authentic, much more in your voice. And it's just simply this. So it's just the skill of restating. And really good restating starts with you being able to offer a short reply. So if you gave me a paragraph worth of things to say, I'm going to restate with just a few words. I'm also not going to repeat verbatim what you just said, because that's super annoying. Like, right? Like, yeah, I just said that. Sometimes you're going to include the emotion. And that's what people really want, is that you're making a change that's going to affect my role. And I'm going to give you all, you know, the reasons why I don't think this should happen and, you know, and so on. But really at the core of it, the essence is that you feel disrespected because you weren't involved in that decision. Or you feel frustrated because you've been trying to solve this problem for a long time and only now are we addressing it. And I think the other thing about this skill, if you really will double down on it, is it makes you much faster and much more effective at getting to the root of problems sooner, versus what I see a lot of managers struggling with is they feel like they're just playing whack-a-mole all day. You know, somebody comes in, what do I do? So they solve instead of listening a little deeper to what's the root of the issue and then solve for that.
I love that. It's like listening for intelligence as opposed to listening for information. Mm. If I'm listening for information, I'm just checking the box. This is what you said. This is what I can say. We move on. But if I listen for intelligence, now I can start establishing root cause, trends, patterns. Maybe I can start aligning or connecting different issues that could all be related that I wasn't previously aware of before. Yeah. I was having a conversation with a client of mine just a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying how a lot of times when people rants, he tunes them out.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, why? He's like, well, I don't have time to listen to them. I was like, do you have time not to listen to them? Mm-hmm. And he looked at me. I said, well, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, man. Mm-hmm. I said, when people start ranting, start listening for patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And he leaned back. He's like, patterns are important. Are there patterns in their individual rants? Are there details that come up in their rant that are coming up in other people's questions, stories, problems too? Are there themes that we can build? Are there trends? Mm-hmm. Is something all of a sudden a break in the pattern? Maybe this is new, different, more important. Like it's an acute problem that has to be addressed now.
Yeah. So
at least if for nothing else, listen for those patterns. So
I love what
you're saying. Is it, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, I promise. Is there an easy example to do, like instead of repeating what I said, to do a restate?
Mm-hmm. You want to do a little example?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do something live. So I'm going to have you just keep talking, and okay. My job will be to restate back to you, okay? Now, I'm not trying to solve your problem. That's a different skill. I'm not going to ask you a question. That's a different skill. I'll try to restate 3 or 4 times. We'll see how it goes.
Sure.
Then we'll do it again. And then I won't restate and we'll see what the difference is. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Sure.
So just start and I'll start restating.
All right. I'll go back to the example that you gave earlier where it's like there's some sort of change coming and I'm frustrated or feel disrespected because I wasn't involved in the decision-making process.
Great. Okay.
So now I'm going to cough in everybody's ear. I apologize. Here we go. So I guess we're at a point where this is going to happen no matter what. And it's far enough down the line and other people have decided that this is what's best, even though they didn't take the time to talk to anybody on our team to truly understand how it would impact how we do our job every day.
It feels as though we're making a big mistake and haven't thought through all the elements.
Yeah, it does.
Keep going. Keep going.
Yeah, it does. It feels that way to us because nobody asked us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if you were a part of the process, in some ways you would feel like you're partners in this as opposed to being dragged along.
I mean, we're the ones that do this every day. So we're the ones that are going to understand how much more time it's going to take, how the customers are going to feel, the learning curve for the new application. Mm-hmm. We certainly feel like all of those things should have been considered.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that you do have the eyes on the issues more than you feel others do. And so we're making a big mistake by not having you involved.
Sorry, okay. I paused because I was going to say something and I was like, oh, wait a minute. I don't want that to come across like I'm challenging you live without us preparing for it.
I think restating is so effective in high pressure situations. Mm-hmm. Because let's do this again this time. So rewind the tape.
Got it.
This time I'm not going to restate and we'll see if there's any difference.
Okay, okay? Cool.
Okay. Yeah. So start from the beginning again.
We'll see how close I get to it twice in a row.
So
it looks like we're far enough down the road that this is going to happen no matter what. The decision has been made at another level by another group of people. And regardless of how it's going to impact us at our level every day, somebody else has already decided that this is what's best for us.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have a lot of time to make this decision. And so we did the best we could with what we know. And so is it going to be perfect? No, of course not. But we had to make a call and we had to move fast.
Yeah, that's a big difference because now you're justifying what you did and essentially blowing me off. Like, thank you for saying that out loud, Mike. Here's why we did the right thing, whether you agree with it or not. Now be quiet and go back and do what I told you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so interesting. That just took maybe 10 seconds for you to feel. It seems like you felt very different with round two.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like the first one, you were turning it into a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was, thanks, sit there, be quiet. I'm in charge. And I would imagine that when leaders at any level in an organization give a response like you did the second time, mm-hmm. they're probably doing it from what they believe is a good place.
Oh,
it might
yeah.
not feel defensive to them. It's almost like an informed apology. Like, well, here's what we were facing. Here's the problems we were having. Here's why we had to make this decision. Here's the good intentions we had. Right. Well, congratulations for you. That doesn't make me feel any better in this situation.
It often even like raises the temperature on the conversation.
Yeah.
Because now I'm justifying something to you. I'm not listening to your point of view. Because here's the interesting thing that I think is hard about restating is it's not agreement. It's simply, I understand from your point of view, how you're seeing this. And it requires you to be vulnerable, because to say out loud, you think I'm the reason this isn't working, or you think that we made a big mistake by not including you, that you're going to not want to say that because you're thinking, oh my gosh, I don't want Michael to believe that I believe him. But when you say, yeah, that's how it feels, or that's how it seems, then you can offer your point of view. I disagree. We took in all points of view before we made that decision. So you don't leave it just with, you know, restating. It's more likely that you will listen to me only after I acknowledge your point of view. I don't have to agree with it, but if I don't acknowledge it, you're going to keep, you know, making your point. I'm going to keep making my point, and it takes a lot of time and not a lot of things get resolved. We'll eventually end this conversation. You'll go back, talk to your team of like, well, it doesn't matter what we say. And I'm going to walk back saying, you know, all they do is put roadblocks in front of our plans. And so yep. I often call it the like Superman of leadership skills, because it's so unassuming, right? It's like Clark Kent, like, yeah, I listen all day, I'm in meetings. But I mean, it, you know, if you really learn the skill of restating, it is a superpower.
I agree completely. I had another thought, and then you said it's a superpower, and I agreed, and I'd kick my own thought out of my brain. But I love that entire approach. Oh, I couldn't agree any more strongly with, you said there's a huge difference between accepting and agreeing.
Mm-hmm.
A huge difference. Mm-hmm. And I find that when people challenge you, not mm-hmm. the royal you, not necessarily mm-hmm. you, Therese,
yeah,
but sure. They're expecting the argument. Like they push, right. They expect you to push back. So
yes.
When they push and you pull, they're not prepared for that. It takes them out of their, sometimes I'll joke and I'll say, keep a straight face when their face turns into a pretzel. Yeah. Like they were expecting you to do one thing and you did the opposite. So yeah. Now they expect you to push back, but you're actually pulling them into the conversation. And
yeah.
Now by pulling them into the conversation, we have the opportunity to try to work through this together.
It's like a judo move.
Yeah.
You know, it's now I'm, you know, we're saying this and I think you and I both are aligned. It's not to use it maliciously.
No,
it's to use it of, you know, there's no positive outcome of us not being able to understand each other. We don't have to agree. We should understand each other. And it's counterintuitive sometimes to how we think, like, I got to get my point across to you and I got to get you to agree. And you know, I found that just when this is again a choice, you can just keep making your point. You can offer more, you know, reasons and all that. But if another choice is downshift to what are they really trying to get across to me? And then what I have found is that when I restate and you say, yeah, kind of feels that way, or yes, because when I restate well, you're going to tell me your response is going to be like, yeah, I do feel like you left us out of the loop. That's my signal that I understood you. And now it's like my green light to say, well, Michael, let me offer, you know, how we went about this decision. Let me give you a little bit of behind the scenes of why we did it the way we did it. And now you're probably a little bit more receptive to at least listening.
Oh, for sure. And one of the great little tricks in there too is demonstrating you understand without saying I understand.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize that if someone either directly or indirectly is telling you, you don't understand,
uh-huh.
and you come back and say to them directly or indirectly, I understand.
Yeah.
We just started an argument that we can never win.
It right.
doesn't matter how well we truly do understand. If they don't want to believe it, they never will. By
so
giving
good.
Them the evidence that you have at least some understanding of the situation,
mm-hmm.
it lowers their guard enough to be willing to listen.
Completely. I understand is not a restatement.
No.
Because what do you understand? You have to verbalize, or I'll hear, I understand, but, which is right? Fuel to the fire.
I understand, but I don't care.
Right, right. Here's also the sophisticated way to use it. So I was observing a senior leader a couple weeks ago, and he was introducing a change that's going to happen. And somebody said, are there any questions? And someone says, is senior leadership really behind this? And he simply answered the question, yes, they're behind it. This is a big rock for 2025. Now, what he wasn't doing was listening at a deeper level, because that was not the real question. The real question that person had was, you know, we seem to be changing priorities all the time. Like one day it's this, next day it's this. How do we know this priority isn't going to change in, you know, a quarter? That was what the person's real question was. And that person had this missed opportunity to listen deeper because, you know, it was unresolved. And maybe you've had this experience like I have, the meeting after the meeting. You know, the one where we all come afterwards and we're like, can you believe they said that? Like, really? Do they actually think we're going to have enough resources to pull this off? Like, they're kidding themselves. That meeting that happened after mm-hmm. shouldn't happen when you're a better listener, even to be able to say, what's behind that question? You know, you can say, yeah, senior leadership is behind, but what are you curious about? And if that person feels, you know, that you're going to genuinely listen, they might say, well, we've changed our mind a lot about priorities and we're going to be, you know, pulling resources away from project A to project B. What's going to happen to project B? Because you also said that was a priority, right? Or we're all like burnt out. We're, you know, you're asking us to do more with less. How are we possibly going to do this? That was the real conversation that needed to happen and didn't happen because that leader wasn't listening deeper and then restating, you know? And so the restatement could have been, you think that we're asking you to do more than is fair, or you think that it's, we're not consistent with the vision and strategy for this company. That would be vulnerable for a leader to say. Doesn't mean you agree with it, but they might say, well, you know, it's not that I don't think our, you know, strategy is firmly in place. It's just that I sometimes think that senior leadership doesn't talk to each other. So one person's initiative and another person's initiative, you know, is going to take a lot of resources, and one layer down, we got to figure it out without support. So
another good example, and that ties back into a couple of things that you mentioned earlier. One quick thought before I forget it is, yeah, I feel like in that scenario where we missed the question behind the question, so to speak, because we're listening to the words, not the emotions.
Yes.
So if we're only paying attention to the words that somebody says, it feels mm-hmm. like we're answering the question that we're asking. But to your point, mm-hmm. if we can pick up on the emotional connotation based on how the question was delivered, now we can start understanding what the real question was, which ties into a couple of things that you talked about earlier. One, and I'm probably not going to say it the same. So what I heard you say was, no, I'm going to summarize it differently, I'm sure. But often when we're under stress, we go to what we know, which is our competencies or our slide deck or what we've prepared. So if I'm a leader in front of an audience and I don't necessarily like getting challenged publicly, which most people don't, that's not an indemnification on anybody or any leader. And I get a question like, well, is senior leadership behind this? Obviously, the faster the word yes can come out of my mouth, the better, because this is a stressful moment for me. And if I don't feel like yes is enough, I'm probably going to reinforce what my partner just said, or the strategy behind the plan, or why this is a big rock and how it turns into our strategic plan. So I'm falling back on my competencies while also falling short with my awareness. Mm-hmm. And awareness is something that you mentioned earlier in the conversation, and I believe is a large part or large-ish part of what you do. Mm-hmm. So how do you work with, when I say leaders, like really at anybody at any stage in the organization, how do you work with people to help them increase their awareness?
Yeah, there's a couple ways, and really it would be starting with listening. Because you said it earlier too, we often are inwardly focused, right? How do I look? How do I sound? What are they going to think of me? I'm nervous. You know, how do I get this done right? Instead of turning our attention to others. And so I typically work on listening, because that forces you out of your own point of view. And the second thing is mindset, because if you're not, again, thinking around, you know, how do I make this group feel, you know, I want to make this group feel comfortable to tell me the real truth. Or, you know, when I listen, I'm actually more respected. It's a counterintuitive thing. Sometimes people think the more I talk, the more, you know, credible I sound, or, you know, confident, and it can be the opposite. And so to build awareness, it's, you know, how do I turn my focus away from me to others? And then how do I have a set of skills to be able to build my awareness? And so one thing we haven't talked about yet, but is still in the realm of listening, is asking questions. Mm-hmm. Because you'll build awareness by drawing people out, because then they'll tell you more. And, you know, your example before too is, it's not just how the question was asked, or was what the question was, it was how it was asked, right? So here's one example. I would love to wipe off the face of the earth this one single question that I hear probably 4 or 5 times a day. You ready? It is, any questions? Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you.
Why do you also not enjoy that question, Michael?
Because it makes the other person feel embarrassed if they have to answer it honestly. If I'm the smart person in front of the room and I just gave instructions, directions, whatever, and I say, do you have any questions? In my heart of hearts, I might really want to answer them. But now for the person in front of me to say, yes, I have a question, they're risking the single biggest fear of all, which is embarrassment or judgment. Ooh. If I ask a question, are you going to think I'm stupid, incapable, not paying attention, not interested, disrespectful? So I'm better off looking at you and saying, not Therese, I'm good. And then either asking one of my peers, looking it up on the internet, or trying to figure it out myself and waiting till this thing's a 4-alarm fire before I come back and ask for help.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sad and so true. I think the other thing happens though too, which is just like, I don't know, any questions about what? Like, I mean, we just had a meeting for 45 minutes. I mean, are you asking me about the last thing you said or the first thing you said? And I just find if your listeners get frustrated to meetings where it's just like, it's like pulling teeth to get people to talk. Everybody's silent. I'm the only one talking. It's so easy to blame the group. But I would look internally and say, what questions am I asking that demonstrate my genuine curiosity and are more likely to get people talking? So instead of any questions, you have to ask something more curious. For instance, you might say, all right, we covered a lot of ground here. What are you most excited about in terms of what you heard? Or what do you think are going to be the challenges about how we're going to do this? Or how does this relate to your experience, you know, last quarter? Now, those are questions that have a little bit more direction and are going to, one, require people to think and most likely, you know, respond. The other thing, I think, to your point about if you want to get people to be willing to open up, and, you know, it's vulnerable to answer, like, if I have any questions, I don't want to look bad in front of my peers. You have to preview and give context to that question. For instance, you might say, look, it's pretty normal for there to be a lot of concerns about how this will all work. So what questions do you have about what the next step would be? Right. Or, another thing is, I'm not looking for a right or wrong answer here. Just looking for, what does everybody think about taking this approach? So you're not putting people on the spot. I was working with one leader who, this was like a light bulb moment. He goes, oh, I get it. I sometimes will ask my direct reports, why did you do it that way? And he said, they immediately get defensive, right? Like, we fill in the blanks. Like, well, you must think I did it wrong. So now I'm going to justify why I did it this way. And he's like, it always becomes like this tense conversation. And he said, but, you know, I'm trying to think about how we're going to innovate the company. And so I'm trying to listen, you know, as I travel the territories, to learn a little bit more about best practices, not to try to catch someone in a mistake. I said, oh, well, how would they possibly know that by simply asking, why did you do it that way? And I think it's an easy thing because we're all moving super fast to assume that people know where your question is coming from. And they'll be wrong more than they'll be right. So mm-hmm. we just worked on, okay, well, what context could you give to making someone open up to that question? And it was the simple one, right? Like, you know, I'm not looking to find any fault. I'm trying to think bigger picture about how we innovate. Walk me through why you did it that way. And now that person's going to open up, tell you more, maybe even give ideas. And it's so simple. That's probably the one thing, if your listeners can take something away, that they can immediately do. It's add context to your questions. You're going to get better answers, more detailed answers. And, you know, I don't know if you face this, but I'll get texts or Slacks that say, Do you have a second? What's your impression when you get those, you know?
Maybe.
Right?
Give me a little context before I sign myself up for something I shouldn't have.
Right? Like, well, wait, I'm in the middle of like a really important thing. Is this worth breaking my flow? Or is it's like, you know, it depends on the context. If the context is, hey, one of our biggest customers is in the office today and I want to introduce you to them. Do you have a second? I'm going to be like, let me stop what I'm doing. Here I come. But if it's like something hilarious just happened, do you have a second? Then you might be like, later, you know, let's catch a beer after work. And we do it not of bad intention. Like I've done it. I have to catch myself. Like, I used to work in, an HR function for a really large company, and I had a team that reported to me, and I'm walking between meeting to meeting. And, I turned to someone, one of my direct reports, and I look over her cube and I'm like, hey, can you meet me in my office for a second? And so I walk in, she walks in, blood drained from her face. And she's like, are you going to fire me? I'm like, what? Why would you think that? I had something I wanted to show you that was at my desk. And of course, because I didn't give her context to why I asked her to do that. And so it's a good litmus test. If you find like, gosh, every time I ask the question, even typing it in an email, and I get like long diatribes back, where it takes forever to answer a question, it's because they're trying to figure out why are you asking that question. And that's going to take longer because they're going to try to imagine every variation of where that might be coming from.
And they're typically going to start with the most negative and then work their way from there.
Oh, 100%.
They're not going to assume positive intent ever.
No. And this is true even with, you know, good relationships. I was working with a client and we were getting ready for a big meeting with the senior team the next day. And so we're walking to our cars after prepping and everything. And I have a good relationship with him. And he turns to me and he goes, so, Therese, do you feel ready for tomorrow? I immediately, my self-talk was, he doesn't think I'm ready. He's worried how I'm going to show up. He's, you know, going to be embarrassed by me. And I said, can you tell me why you're asking? And he said, oh, I just feel like you carried more weight. You did a lot more work to get us to this point. And if you feel like I'm not doing my fair share, I'll work on some of those slides tonight and I can deliver them. Well, that is nowhere near what I thought. And we had a good relationship. Like I had no reason to think he was, you know, trying to manipulate a situation. So yes, it happens all the time. We're moving fast. We think it's obvious and it rarely is.
I can't use the words always or never, right? But I think we can get pretty close to it's never obvious. There's exceptions that prove every rule, but assuming it won't be obvious is a far safer way to approach than assuming it will be obvious. And I just want to take a second and call out that adding context before the question is supremely important. And you touched on one of my absolute favorite things, the question, please walk me through. That is a question that I will ask as often as possible. Mm. So replacing why with please walk me through, fantastic. I mean, I'll save the diatribe, but the way it lands on people's brains, forces them to think, gives you the opportunity to evaluate the answer, allows them to add additional context to details. Yeah. One of my absolute favorite questions to ask.
Yeah. I'll give you another one, particularly to your point earlier of like, if you ask questions and people are going to feel vulnerable, like I can't raise my hand and say, I don't know. Try this one. This is one of my favorites. I'll say, What else do you feel like you need to know in order to get started on this? That's different than any questions. Or I'll preview it. I'll say, there's a lot of complex steps to what we're going to be doing after we end this meeting. So it's going to be obvious that you'd have some questions. So what's coming to mind in terms of what your, next step might be? Or, walk me through how you would imagine applying this.
I like all of those. May I share my favorite?
Yeah.
So for me, it all comes down to, how do I help people save face? Yeah. That's the number one riddle I want to solve every time. If I want somebody to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the faces of perceived consequences, I've got to help them save face. Yeah. So I love your preview. So for me, sometimes, and everybody's different, I might be too self-deprecating sometimes. I've been coached on that more than once, especially by my wife. Sorry, honey. But I might say something like, a lot of times things make crystal clear sense in here, as I point to my head, but not so much sense out here, as I kind of gesture in front of my face. And then I'll say, how many questions have I created?
I'm going to take that one.
Please. That's and when that great. One runs dry, or if you need a curveball because you're in the same meeting, it's how many questions have I created? What's the most important question I've created? Mm-hmm. All the questions I've created, which one should I answer first? And sometimes in like a group setting, if you go back to the example you gave earlier, like I'm expecting conversation, I'm getting none.
Yeah.
I'll do the old pause to think and then say, let me hang on for a second. Often at this point in the conversation, the first two questions I typically get, or the first two questions I was expecting to get are one, two. How does that line up with any questions I've created so far?
I collect good questions like jewels, and you just added to my collection. So
take them all, please.
And the other thing, I'll make this one last tie to one other of the contributions, and that's balancing risk and safety.
Yes.
And oftentimes, what you just described was creating the safety for people to raise their hand or express confusion or doubt or whatever. And we often, as leaders, have to surf the polarity, because we want to create safety, but at certain times we're also trying to create risk in that we're trying to get people to change. And it's no different than, if you've ever gone to a personal trainer, and if you went to a personal trainer and you walked out after spending good money and an hour with them, and you didn't break a sweat, and you didn't feel any, stretch in your muscles, what would you think?
I wasted my money.
Yeah. And what if you went to that person and the opposite happened? You strained your back, right? Now, you're feeling, that old injury in your Achilles, and, you're feeling, you're like, heart palpitations. What are you thinking then?
I wasted my money.
Yeah, you wasted your money, right?
Kill me.
And so we've got to find this way to create a certain level of safety. But if you only create safety all the time, then you're probably not helping a group of people move forward at the rate you need to, at the rate the change is happening to all of us. And so it's, there's what feels risky to you, what doesn't feel risky to others. In the book, my co-author Kat tells this great story of talking about money with clients. And when it came down to, the proposal stage, or here's what it's going to cost, she felt that was risky for her to talk about money. But for the client, that was like, well, no, of course, that's, we're at that stage. So sometimes is it feel risky to you? It doesn't mean it'll feel risky to others. Or vice versa, right? Like, you feel like, let's get all the problems out on the table. Let's just have at it. And everybody else is like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, then that means we're going to have to push people into the bus. We're going to have to name names. And I'm not going to do that. So there's your risk. There's others' risks. And you have to be able to, back to awareness, be able to understand that and then create the conditions where you are balancing risk and safety.
I couldn't agree more. And I would love your thought on this. And I know we're getting close on time, but I want to be very respectful of your schedule. I feel like often the best way to do that comes down to, how do we handle the mistakes people make?
Yeah.
Because they are at their most vulnerable mm-hmm. when they've made a mistake or done something they shouldn't have or whatever. Right. So over time, if we help them, if we're patient enough and forward thinking enough to help them save face, to maybe share some mistakes that we've made or lessons we've learned the hard way, to help create an action plan, not just a reprimand, like what did we learn from this? How are we going to move forward from this? The more we can use their most vulnerable moments to build trust, then the more they will be willing to accept risk with us as our relationship grows.
Exactly.
Couldn't say it any better. Perfect.
So one other thing I wanted to call out, I probably should have done it earlier, but I know we have to wrap up. When I was on your website prior to the conversation, somewhere on there, I think when you were talking about your speaking engagements or something that you do, one of the questions that you like to ask is, what do you want people understanding, feeling, and doing? Mm-hmm. I love that. Mm. For me, I feel like to go back to something you said in the absolute front edge of this conversation, if we look at everybody as our audience, if we're going to try to move them from point A to point B, mm-hmm. then what do they need to understand, maybe most importantly, feel before mm-hmm. they do? Mm-hmm. And then as we create that understanding and feeling, are they doing the thing we want them to do? I don't know how many times a week I ask my son to do something. He does something else. I call him out on it. And he turns around and eloquently, as an elementary school kid, explains to me why he feels like he's doing exactly what I told him to do. And I have to stand there and go, damn it, I got outsmarted by a 7-year-old again. I wasn't clear enough. And I have to explain it one more time. So I love how that's your approach.
Well, we talked about obviously lots of applications for this. Another big one is in your personal life, parenting, relationships with, you know, a partner, with extended family. So yeah, I think everybody needs it.
So I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for all that you shared today. I truly appreciate it. I know everybody else listening has enjoyed it. So where do they need to go to connect with you, to learn more from you, to experience your content, to buy your book, all of it? Where do we need to go?
Okay. First, I would say find me on LinkedIn because I post 4, 5, 6 times a week on topics like this. And it's all really geared towards leaders, technical people that are needing to kind of advance their career. So find me on LinkedIn. Next thing is there's a free self-assessment on the book website, which is all one word, thefacilitationadvantage.com. And what I invite everybody to do is it's a very quick way to look at those 10 contributions and just then pinpoint where might you want to start or even just focus, because don't try to do everything at once. We're all too busy for that. Pick one thing. And then the book offers and is designed in a way where I don't think a lot of people read cover to cover anymore because our attention spans are like gnats. So the book is written where if you focus just on the skill you need, if it's listening, maybe you got to get better at storytelling. Maybe you've got to get better at engaging with presence or self-talk, like we talked about, then there's really practical tips to just help you immediately with those areas. So book can be bought from the website, Amazon, your favorite place to buy books and materials. And I'd love to stay connected with you and your listeners.
Oh, for certain. I appreciate that. I look forward to staying in touch and continuing to learn from you. Thank you so very much for sharing your time today. I will have all of those links in the show notes so people do not have to go looking for them. They will be right there. And at some point before the weekend is over, I'm going to reach out to connect with you on LinkedIn too, so I can keep an eye on what you're posting. So thank you so very much. I'm grateful for all your time and everything you shared today. Please stay safe, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. Therese, thank you for a fantastic conversation. It was great meeting you. I really enjoyed the entire conversation. Thank you for making it a conversation as we talk through. And I appreciate you sharing your perspectives, your work, and the very specific examples, not just the concepts of how we can apply facilitation skills, but the specific questions, the specific examples. I really, really appreciate all that you shared today. Thank you. On the surface, yes, increasing our influence, improving how we listen, and not just applying these skills to formal presentations, if you will, but all of our conversations is important. I love your thought about previewing the context before asking our questions. I thought that was a fantastic point. Really was intrigued by your conversation on increasing our performance range. And like we mentioned, to kick this off, separating justifying from listening. All great points and a wonderful conversation. Thank you so very much. And of course, thank you to everybody that took the time to listen to the conversation. Hopefully you were taking notes just like I was, and now you have new perspectives to imply in your high value conversations in your business and your personal lives. Before you go, please, like we said, take a second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to it, leave us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you, and check out our sponsors, humantel.com. Head over there, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best in-class online training to develop the ability to understand what people are likely thinking and feeling by recognizing shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. I've done all the training myself. I highly recommend it. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. Get all your questions about the International Association of Interviewers answered, all of the online training, in-person training, education, partnership, networking, all the ways you can contribute. And of course, that's where you can get your questions answered on the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And finally, while you're online, go check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize to teach their senior leaders, sales teams, negotiating teams, HR teams, and more how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. Thank you for being here week after week. We truly appreciate it. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.